So this is our third installment of Faith Seeking Understanding, highlighting John Henry Newman and some of the themes that were important in his writings and that I think are still important to our life of faith today. Just a very brief recap. The first night we did the biographical sketch, sort of situate Blessed Newman within history. And then last week we looked at the question of the development of Christian doctrine. Anybody that was here last week, remember any highlights from that discussion on the development of Christian doctrine? Any images, any words that come to mind? Right, so we got into a discussion of doctrine and dogma, so looking at different types of church teaching that hold different sort of weights. We kind of got off on discussion of the magisterium. What is it, the teaching office of the church? When is something infallible? When is it not? There's, you know, lots of different avenues we can go down there. And it's important to think about those things as Catholics. But at the same time, I don't want to get too far afield in technical definitions. But certainly keep bringing those questions up if something isn't clear. Dan? Right. So he had those sort of notes on, you know, how can you tell if something is an authentic development of doctrine versus something that is a corruption of church teaching. And we talked about how they're not it's not a hard and fast proof. You can't just take those notes and come up with something new and say, well, look, it fits all the criteria, so it must be true. But remember that his whole essay on the development of Christian doctrine was more of a retrospective exercise, trying to understand how it is the church had arrived to this point today when he recognized that certain changes had been made, certain developments had occurred in the way the faith was expressed. And so that image of the acorn to the oak tree, recognizing that it's natural in the life of an organism, even of an idea, to sometimes change shape, change look in certain ways as it develops further into itself. This evening, I'd like to discuss another topic that was very important for Newman, especially given his historical circumstances, and that is the conscience, Christian conscience. What is a conscience? We'll start here with a little bit of participation. Anybody that's that wants to weigh in. It's a concept that we use. I think all of us would recognize that conscience is a part of our experience. It's part of our understanding of our relationship with God. But what is it? James, how do you understand the conscience?
I don't understand that which moves at us and tells us something that is wrong.
That which pulls at us, tells us something we're doing may not be right. Something may be wrong. Absolutely, that's part of it.
Something that could be right.
Something that could be right. That's good. You know, it's not just a negative thing. It's certainly helps us to make that judgment. Yeah, with the angel, the devil on each shoulder, or you know, Jiminy Cricket, let your conscience be your guide. And this is very much a part of our cultural air that we breathe. But Newman recognizes that the conscience can also be misinterpreted, and it can lead us down, you know, a path of error if we misunderstand what the conscience is or give the name of conscience to something that's not really conscience. And so we'll look at the way Newman distinguishes conscience from false imitations. We'll do that by reading a little passage from one of Newman's letters. If you remember, in the portion where we talked about his biography, we talked about how a lot of Newman's teaching, a lot of his theology, is actually found in personal letters. He was a prolific letter writer, kept up all kinds of relationships, so he wasn't always sitting down writing a formal essay, but often responding to challenges and involved in ongoing dialogue with others. And so our source for Newman on conscience is a letter that he wrote to the Duke of Norfolk in response to a certain Mr. Gladstone who had criticized this new, then new doctrine of papal authority, of papal infallibility. And so we'll get there in a few moments, where the question of papal infallibility comes in. But first of all, just to hear how Newman talks about conscience, what it is and what it isn't. He says, "Our great internal teacher of religion is, as I have said in an earlier part of this essay, our conscience." So our great internal teacher of religion, that's one of the first ways that he defines conscience. "Conscience is a personal guide, and I use it because I must use myself. I am as little able to think by any mind but my own as to breathe with another's lungs." Affirming, we have to think with our own mind. We have to make our own judgments, just like that, to breathe with our own lungs. "Conscience is nearer to me than any other means of knowledge. And as it is given to me, so also it is given to others. And being carried about by every individual of his own breast, and requiring nothing besides itself, it is thus adapted for the communication to each separately of that knowledge which is most momentous to him individually." He then goes on to talk about God, the Supreme Being. He says God has a certain character. He has the attributes of justice, truth, wisdom, sanctity, benevolence, and mercy as eternal characteristics in his nature, the very law of his being, identical with himself. And next, when he became creator, he implanted this law, which is himself, in the intelligence of all his rational creatures. The divine law, then, is the rule of ethical truth, the standard of right and wrong, a sovereign, irreversible, absolute authority in the presence of men and angels. So big picture, he's talking about God and his eternal attributes. When God became creator, he created men and women. He gave us a faculty by which we could contain his truth. We could contain some of those characteristics. He implanted this law, which is himself, in the intelligence of all his rational creatures. So he's giving us a faculty. There's something in our intelligence implanted by God. This law, as apprehended in the minds of individual men, is called conscience. And though it may suffer refraction in passing into the intellectual medium of each, it is not therefore so affected as to lose its character of being the divine law, but still has, as such, the prerogative of commanding obedience. So certainly, we lose something of God's perfection, of the clarity of God's divine law in our faulty human nature. But it says this doesn't take away the fact that it truly is the presence of the divine law within us. He then goes on to distinguish this from other popular notions of conscience, popular in his time and probably still in ours. It says, "This view of conscience, I know, is very different from that ordinarily taken of it, both by the science and literature, and by the public opinion of this day. This view that he's pronouncing, it is founded on the doctrine that conscience is the voice of God, whereas it is fashionable on all hands now to consider it in one way or another a creation of man. Conscience is not a long-sighted selfishness, nor a desire to be consistent with oneself, but it is a messenger from him who, both in nature and in grace, speaks to us behind a veil, and teaches and rules us by his representatives. When men advocate the rights of conscience, they in no sense mean the rights of the Creator, nor the duty to him in thought and deed of the creature." So he's talking about this popular notion of conscience that's at odds with the Christian notion. This false notion is one in which we don't think about the Creator as being part of that. "But they think rather the right of thinking, speaking, writing, and acting according to their judgment or their humor, without any thought of God at all. It becomes a license to take up any or no religion, to take up this or that and let it go again, to go to church, to go to chapel, to boast of being above all religions, and to be an impartial critic of each of them. Conscience is a stern monitor, but in this century it has been superseded by a counterfeit, which the 18 centuries prior to it never heard of, and could not have mistaken for it if they had. It is the right of self-will." So, we'll stop there for now with that distinction one that's pretty simple to understand, I think, but fundamental when we're thinking about what is conscience when we talk about it. In a Christian sense, Newman points out, conscience is recognizing that there's a God and that God speaks to us. He talks about through our intelligence. We might talk about it in our hearts, our interior life. He says this is different from a long-sighted selfishness, one that just wants to kind of feel out what I feel like doing without any regard to some sort of higher law, if you will, or some sort of objective external truth to my own whims, my own feelings. So he felt it was necessary to make that distinction. Big question that came up for him, and that's why he spilled so much ink on the question of conscience, happened when at Vatican I, after Vatican I, there was this affirmation of the infallibility of the Pope. And that brought up a lot of criticisms, a lot of questions from his non-Catholic friends. Remember that he came from an Anglican environment. He was an Anglican priest first and then converted. And so he was challenged, especially by a certain Gladstone, who challenged him directly and provoked Newman to write this response. So as we get into that response, what's the relationship between conscience and the authority of the Church? Do we have any ideas already or any understandings? When I say that, if someone were to ask you, hey, you're a Catholic, you think the Pope's infallible, which we know is already a simplification, how do you understand the authority of your conscience in relationship to the authority of a church, to this magisterium that has a teaching authority? Which one wins, your conscience or the magisterium? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent point and an excellent answer to that hypothetical question. So we have to get into the conversation of what is a well-formed conscience. So we have that responsibility to form our conscience, and that includes informed by the teaching of the Church. And we'll look at that a little more specifically in detail in a few moments. Anybody else have any different response to someone who challenged you on the relationship of your conscience and this external teaching authority? And so in obedience to faith, give the Church the benefit of the doubt, yeah. Basically. Yep. Right. So, yeah, and that takes faith, and it also takes a little bit of humility to recognize, well, maybe I'm not seeing things in the full picture. But that's another avenue, and Newman will hit on both of those. So I'd just like to read the pronouncement from the First Vatican Council that talks about papal infallibility, because that came up last week. How does that language come out when the Church makes such a statement? So this is what was published, and then we'll look at kind of the back and forth between Newman and Gladstone, and then go forward and even look at what the Catechism says now, which we'll see is very much informed by Newman, among other sources. But for the time being, it's helpful and I think fun to put ourselves in the position of the characters involved here, where this is a very new teaching, and it's something that's urgent for Christians to understand. You know, how does this make sense, this question of my conscience in relationship to the teaching authority of the Church? So in the Constitution from the First Vatican Council, this came out in 1870, the Constitution Pastor Eternus, here's a key part of the description of papal infallibility. Therefore, faithfully adhering to the tradition received from the beginning of the Christian faith, to the glory of God our Savior, for the exaltation of the Catholic religion, and for the salvation of the Christian people, with the approval of the Sacred Council, We teach and define as divinely revealed dogma that when the Roman pontiff speaks ex cathedra, that is, when in the exercise of his office as shepherd and teacher of all Christians, in virtue of his supreme apostolic authority, he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals to be held by the whole church. He possesses, by the divine assistance promised to him and blessed Peter, that infallibility which the divine Redeemer willed his church to enjoy in defining doctrine concerning faith or morals. Therefore, such definitions of the Roman pontiff are of themselves, and not by the consent of the church, irreformable. There's only one period in that whole paragraph, so it's kind of weighty with a lot of church language. But we hear the important part coming through is declaring that this belief that this was God's will to give his church this kind of authority to keep it from error, ultimately. And the Roman pontiff, speaking in that very formal fashion, exercising his office as shepherd and teacher of all Christians through the apostolic authority, when he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals, he possesses divine assistance promised to him in Blessed Peter. And from this comes that infallibility that Christ wanted his church to enjoy in defining doctrine concerning faith and morals. So that's what the church put out there. We mentioned Mr. Gladstone taking issue to that. And he said, wait a second, we've been talking about conscience as this authority, this way that God speaks to us in our hearts, in our depths, in our intelligence. He says, how does that absolute authority, doesn't that violate the Christian conscience? For what would become of the Pope's absolute authority, as Mr. Gladstone calls it, if the private conscience had an absolute authority also? So Newman takes this question seriously, and he answers it in this letter to the Duke of Norfolk. So he says, first of all, let's remember we're talking about conscience, the real thing, not some sort of relativism of somebody doing whatever they feel like in the moment. Let's have a proper understanding of conscience. He thought that was important. Then he said, importantly, I observe that conscience is not a judgment upon any speculative truth, any abstract doctrine, but bears immediately on conduct, on something to be done or not done. Conscience, says St. Thomas, is the practical judgment or dictate of reason by which we judge what hic et nunc, is here and now, is to be done as being good or to be avoided as evil. So he says, conscience, it's not talking about speculative truth. It's not talking about some sort of theological doctrine. Conscience has to do with discerning an action, a concrete act, here and now. Hence, Newman continues, conscience cannot come into direct collision with the church's or the Pope's infallibility, which is engaged in general propositions and in the condemnation of particular and given errors. This is kind of the first big move that Newman makes to sort this out. He says we're talking about two different fields, basically, here. The church, in defining these doctrines and dogmas, is talking about sort of general speculative truths. It's not talking about something that I'm going to be doing right now in this moment in these given circumstances. He says, next I observe that conscience being a practical dictate, a collision is possible between it and the Pope's authority only when the Pope legislates or gives particular orders and the like. But a Pope is not infallible in his laws, nor in his commands, nor in his acts of state, nor in his administration, nor in his public policy. Let it be observed that the Vatican Council has left him just as it found him here. Mr. Gladstone's language on this point is to me quite unintelligible. So he's saying Gladstone's putting things in the church's teaching's mouth that aren't there. He says, why, instead of using vague terms, does he not point out precisely the very words by which the council has made the Pope and his acts infallible? And then he goes on to list certain things throughout history that popes did that certainly were not infallible. He says, was St. Peter infallible on that occasion at Antioch when St. Paul withstood him? Was St. Victor infallible when he separated from his communion the Asiatic churches, or Liberius, when in like manner he excommunicated Athanasius. And to come to later times, was Gregory the 13th, when he had a medal struck in honor of the Bartholomew Massacre, or Paul the 4th in his conduct towards Elizabeth, or Sextus the 5th, when he blessed the Armada, or Urban the 8th, when he persecuted Galileo. No Catholic ever pretends that these popes were infallible in these acts, since the infallibility alone could block the exercise of conscience, and the pope is not infallible in that subject matter in which conscience is of supreme authority. No deadlock, such as implied in the objection which I am observing, can take place between conscience and the pope. Again, further making his point, there are these times when popes have done all kinds of things. We look back and think, well, he shouldn't have done that. At that time, he wasn't exercising this faculty of teaching something to the entire Christian church on faith and morals. Finally, and this would be the last kind of long quote, and I'm reading a lot from him, but he explains it well. He says, "But of course, I have to say again, lest I should be misunderstood, that when I speak of conscience, I mean conscience truly so called. When it has the right of opposing the supreme, though not infallible, authority of the Pope, it must be something more than that miserable counterfeit, which, as I have said above, now goes by the name." So he says, okay, when we're talking about something that's not an infallible teaching, when does conscience have the right to oppose it? First of all, it has to be real conscience. It can't be that miserable counterfeit that he just mentioned. If in a particular case it is to be taken as a sacred and sovereign monitor, its dictate, in order to prevail against the voice of the Pope, must follow upon serious thought, prayer, and all available means of arriving at a right judgment on the matter in question. So there's that formation of the conscience that's necessary. And further, obedience to the Pope is what is called in possession, that is, the onus probandi, the burden of proof of establishing a case against him, lies, in all cases of exception, on the side of conscience. So those are both things that Bev and Louise responded. On the one, well, we have to form our conscience in order for it to be taken seriously, if there's some sort of contrast with church teaching, with papal teaching. And then also, the burden of proof is on our conscience. If there's a teaching that we're having trouble accepting, that we're grappling with, saying it's not impossible for your conscience to come to a different conclusion, but the burden of proof is on that conscience, on that formation of the conscience. So I think what's important to look at, one of the maneuvers that Newman does there, is that looking at conscience in kind of a limited application, but the true application of conscience, which has to do with concrete acts. So it wouldn't be appropriate to say, well, I don't believe in the Immaculate Conception because my conscience doesn't agree with that. Well, we're mixing categories there, because believing in the Immaculate Conception isn't discerning a concrete act in this moment. So going back to James's original response, the conscience, it's that faculty that lets you know if something you're going to do or have already done or considering doing is right or wrong. So when we talk about conscience, we're talking about acts, concrete acts. Now jump forward in time a little bit to our catechism. We've been reading from Newman, looking at these things. We'll see that the catechism is helpful. It clarifies things, and we see that it's in accord with what Newman was talking about. And having some of the historical context of Newman helps us to understand how the church came to articulate the conscience in this way. So our catechism affirms that the moral conscience is present at the heart of the person, and joins him or her at the appropriate moment to do good and to avoid evil. And it also judges particular choices, approving those that are good and denouncing those that are evil. And it's at the heart of the person. There's a slight change in language from Newman talking about the Creator giving us in our intelligence the faculty of conscience. Catechism talks about the heart, but I think we understand that there's just different ways of expressing it's a faculty that's a part of our interior life. It bears witness to the authority of truth in reference to the supreme good to which the human person is drawn, and it welcomes the commandments. When he listens to his conscience, the prudent man can hear God speaking. Again, affirming, conscience is God speaking in us. Conscience is a judgment of reason, whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act that he is going to perform, is in the process of performing, or is already completed. In all he says and does, man is obliged to follow faithfully what he knows to be just and right. It is by the judgment of his conscience that man perceives and recognizes the prescriptions of the divine law. So, an important point in that paragraph says we are obliged to follow that which we know to be just and right. And that's a question that came up in Newman's writings, and we see it here in our current writings from the Catechism, that we are obliged to follow our conscience. Again, with all those caveats, conscience properly understood, conscience properly formed. But this is serious stuff. This is how God speaks to us when we're in front of the concrete situations of life, often the very complicated and messy situations of life. We're not abandoned to confusion, but God's given us the faculty to cultivate and to exercise, whereby we can know the right way to act. So let's look a little more at what that looks like if we're talking about being obliged to follow it. The Catechism then quotes Newman. I won't reread that because we already talked a lot about this paragraph. But the Catechism quotes the part in which Newman says, conscience is the aboriginal vicar of Christ. So that vicar of Christ, who's been the name given to the Pope, says this is the aboriginal vicar of Christ. The one who speaks in the name of God is in the conscience. And I shared that anecdote, the first meeting we had of Newman was asked, who wins, conscience or Pope? And he said, well, if I were ever asked to give an after-dinner toast, which sometimes comes up in the circles I run in, I would toast first to the conscience and then to the Holy Father. So not putting in opposition to each other, but recognizing the dignity of the conscience. It is important for every person to be sufficiently present to himself in order to hear and follow the voice of his conscience. This is important. In order to hear and follow the voice of our conscience, if we don't want to be misled by our whims, we have to be sufficiently present to ourselves, to have a prayer life, to have an interior life, to know how to discern those spirits, discern those maybe competing voices sometimes, who's on one shoulder or the other shoulder, that image of the angel and devil. This requirement of interiority is all the more necessary as life often distracts us from any reflection, self-examination, or introspection. Return to your conscience. Question it. Turn inward, brethren, and in everything you do, see God as your witness. It's a quote from St. Augustine. So the dignity of the human person implies the uprightness of the moral conscience. This is part of understanding the dignity of the person. You have this faculty to judge and to follow God's voice in your life. Conscience enables one to assume responsibility for the acts performed. Another point worth highlighting. It's about responsibility. Being adults with our faith, being adults with our actions, discerning with our conscience, and recognizing that we're responsible for that. This comes up sometimes, I'm sure in all different fields. As a priest sometimes, and I've even done this to others, you know, you might have people that want to dump off their freedom or their responsibility for a decision onto you. Like, well, what should I do in this situation, Father? Or, Mom, what should I do in this situation? Dad, brother, you make this decision for me. And it's easier for us to sometimes shirk off that responsibility. But the Catechism reminds us this is part of our dignity, our stature as human persons, to be responsible for our actions. It goes on to say, if a man commits evil, the just judgment of conscience can remain within him as the witness to the universal truth of the good, at the same time as the evil of his particular choice. The verdict of the judgment of conscience remains a pledge of hope and mercy. So when we have a guilty conscience, when that conscience is stinging us because we didn't act in accord with what we knew was true, and we feel that sense of healthy guilt, the Catechism articulates it in this way. That verdict of the judgment of the conscience remains a pledge of hope and mercy. Because there is a truth. There is a goodness. And you know, we chose to not act in accord with it. But the very fact that I recognize it was wrong is a pledge of that goodness and mercy that still holds its hand out to us. Man has the right to act in conscience and in freedom so as personally to make moral decisions. He must not be forced to act contrary to his conscience, nor must he be prevented from acting according to his conscience, especially in religious matters. And so we have the right, the obligation of acting in accord with our conscience. Then, appropriately, the Catechism gets into, okay, well, how do we form this conscience? We're saying it's so important to act in accord with it, that we must. It's about our responsibility and dignity. But the conscience must be informed and moral judgment enlightened. A well-formed conscience is upright and truthful. It formulates its judgment according to reason in conformity with the true good willed by the wisdom of the Creator. The education of conscience is indispensable for human beings who are subjected to negative influences and tempted by sin to prefer their own judgment and to reject authoritative teachings. So we have all kinds of influences. We have all kinds of tendencies, our sinfulness, our selfishness, that makes it easy for us to not form our conscience truly. We have that rebellious side of us that if there's an authoritative teaching, well, I'm going to be the bratty teenager that just wants to turn my back on it because I have a problem with authority. The education of the conscience is a lifelong task. And we can say that in a kind of trite way, but when it sinks in, it's extraordinary to think that we have people, you know, in this room, we're of different ages, different levels of experience, but the formation of the conscience is an ongoing task for each of us. No matter how settled we are in our lives, in our faith, we still continue to educate our conscience, to hear that voice of God more clearly. The education of the conscience guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. Guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. Think about when you've been placed in front of a tough decision, maybe. You're trying to discern the way forward, listen to your conscience. If you don't have a clear sense of what God's asking you to do or what the right decision is, it's tough to have peace of heart. And so part of this, seeking that peace of heart, is, well, clarifying our own conscience, educating it. And when we know we act in accord with it, well, peace. We can suffer the consequences if we know that we've acted in accord with the truth as we've done our best to understand it. So concretely, how do we form our conscience? I'll ask you, how do we form our conscience? By doing good things? So doing good things, making the correct decision. So practicing acting in accord with your conscience, with virtue. Yeah, absolutely. That's a way of it, with experience. You start to know what it feels like when you're acting truly. How else might we inform our conscience, our ability to decide for good or evil in concrete acts? Right, so through prayer, and it's good that we remember that we're talking about a relationship with a living God, so certainly prayer, and through study of our faith. And what are things we can study to stay rooted? The Bible. Right, and that's the Catechism puts that as first and foremost the way of forming our conscience. It says, in the formation of conscience, the Word of God is the light for our path. So that's indispensable, the Word of God. We must assimilate it in faith and prayer and put it into practice. We must also examine our conscience before the Lord's cross. It's an interesting phrase. I think it goes in with prayer there. but examine our conscience before the Lord's cross. We could unpack that in different ways. What comes to me is that placing ourselves in front of that sort of naked truth of who God is, what God has done for us, our humanity, our humility, our weakness, and we're just there at the foot of the cross and examining our conscience. And when you cut through everything else, when you cut through all the superficiality, all those other influences, all the BS, get to the heart of it at the Lord's cross, well, that's one of the ways that you form your conscience. We are assisted by the gifts of the Holy Spirit, aided by the witness or advice of others, and guided by the authoritative teaching of the church. So those gifts of the Holy Spirit that were confirmed and awakened in us in confirmation, those help. The advice and guidance of others. Confessors, spiritual directors, friends who are also trying to live a virtuous Christian life. And we're guided by the authoritative teaching of the church. So then there's the magisterium. There's the church's interpretation that we study along with the Word of God. Right. So that, and Newman expresses it a little differently, but basically says the same thing, that we have to form our conscience because, and he points out something the Catechism doesn't mention explicitly, sometimes our emotional immaturity can lead to making the wrong decision, where if we're too emotionally involved or we're immature emotionally, it clouds our reason. And Newman's understanding of conscience is very much connected to this Aristotelian concept of prudence, both of which start with you have certain principles that you're working from, and we have this faculty of prudence or of conscience that's able to discern the right application of the principles of our faith. There was a little anecdote in one of the books on Newman that I read that was pointing out the similarities of some of Aristotle's talk on prudence with Newman on conscience. And he said, could we accuse Newman of just being too philosophical, too much a follower of Aristotle? And the author cited this case of another Oxford don, one of these cultured teachers of religion, where he was up giving a homily, and he went to sit down, and he said, and by the way, every time I said Aristotle in that homily, I really meant to say St. Paul. So I don't think Newman's doing that where he's overdoing it, making it just about Greek philosophy, but showing different ways that different traditions have understood this human capacity to have solid principles upon which we make good decisions. So choosing in accord with the conscience. Faced with a moral choice, the conscience can make either a right judgment in accordance with reason and divine law, or on the contrary, an erroneous judgment that departs from them. We're sometimes confronted by complex situations that make decision-making tough. Catechism allows that. But we must always seriously seek what is right and good and discern the will of God expressed in divine law. So we do our best to interpret the data of experience and the signs of the times, assisted by the virtue of prudence, the advice of competent people, and again, the help of the Holy Spirit and His gifts. Some rules apply in every case. Any guesses? In every case, when we're making a decision of conscience, maybe even a complex decision, what are some rules that might apply in every case? Right. So that's one of them. You can't do evil in order to achieve good. And this is important. I don't think that belief is shared by everyone. We have some of the popular phrases, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet, or the ends justify the means, right? So our faith teaches that the ends don't justify the means, that we're not to do evil acts, even if we can imagine a positive end, because don't know. Why? Anybody have it? So in the case of doing an evil act, you know, you recognize it's evil, you recognize that your conscience says that it's wrong, but you still do it because maybe that pride or self-will thinks, yeah, but I know better in this case. I'm going to do this, and then something better is going to result from it.
Yeah. It shows a lack of trust.
Lack of trust. So that's one. One may never do evil so that good may result from it. There are two more that apply in every case. Does it hurt God or does it hurt another person? So that, yes, I think that would fall into the way it's expressed here is the golden rule. That whatever you wish that men would do for you, do so to them. So this is maybe making it a little more selfish on our part, recognizing, okay, well, don't do something hurtful to another because you wouldn't want them to do it to you. But I think the way that you expressed it would certainly still qualify as a rule, as a criterion of making a decision. You shouldn't cause violence to others or to God. And the third one, actually is what you just said. I should have gone to the third rather than the second. So charity always proceeds by way of respect for one's neighbor and his conscience. Thus sinning against your brethren and wounding their conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, it is right not to do anything that makes your brother stumble. So anything that would do harm to make another person stumble, we shouldn't do it. Finally, what about when we make a wrong decision? Is it possible to make a wrong decision in good conscience? Have you ever done that? I think I have. Where you judge based on the data you have in front of you, the advice that you seek, your best understanding of the situation, and you choose. And then maybe down the road, either right away or it takes a while, you realize, yeah, that wasn't the right decision. I think I erred in that. So what about that? Are we guilty in those times? It wouldn't be a grave error because you weren't doing it with full knowledge of the error there. Yeah, certainly. That's right. And we see that even biblically in the famous case of David with his, when he gets Bathsheba pregnant, he tries to cover up that sin by killing Uriah. So if he would have just owned up to it, it would have been. Well, because he realized he was in too deep. This is going a little on a tangent, but if you look at the narrative in that case, before he sends him to the front of the battle line, he tries to get Uriah drunk and have him go home and sleep with his wife so that people will think the baby is his. So it's this sort of escalation of trying to cover up one sin by committing others to the point of murder. So this is the point that I wanted to draw out there was to your point of admitting it and trying to make amends or to seek forgiveness rather than going forward stubbornly as if it were the right choice. So even in this section on erroneous judgment, it begins by saying a human being must always obey the certain judgment of his conscience. A human being must always obey the certain judgment of his or her conscience. If he were deliberately to act against it, he would condemn himself. Yet it can happen that moral conscience remains in ignorance and makes erroneous judgments about acts to be performed or already committed. So we have to act in accord with it, but we might make mistakes. This ignorance can often be imputed to personal responsibility. So sometimes our ignorance is our fault if we haven't properly formed and informed our conscience. This is the case when a man takes little trouble to find out what is true and good, or when conscience is by degrees almost blinded through the habit of committing sin. In such cases, the person is culpable for the evil he commits. Ignorance of Christ and his gospel, bad example given by others, enslavement to one's passions, assertion of a mistaken notion of autonomy of conscience, rejection of the church's authority and her teaching, lack of conversion and of charity, these can be at the source of errors of judgment and moral conduct. So trying to get at the root of how do we judge poorly? If, on the contrary, the ignorance is invincible, or the moral subject is not responsible for his erroneous judgment, the evil cannot be imputed to him. So if there's no way you could have been responsible for not knowing that and you chose wrongly, then you're not culpable for that evil. It remains no less an evil, a privation, a disorder. One must therefore work to correct the errors of moral conscience. And it ends on that point that you made, Michelle. Yet when you said by acting in accord with our conscience, we form our conscience. So this section ends with that point. But the more a correct conscience prevails, the more do persons and groups turn aside from blind choice and try to be guided by objective standards of moral conduct. So the more our conscience prevails, the more we get a sense of what it feels like to be acting in accord with it. And we start to desire to act in accord with what forms us in the truth. So just a few points that I want to draw out that we can leave with today, and we can discuss for a few minutes here. But what is a conscience? To distinguish a conscience, as we understand as Christians, is the voice of God that speaks to us and helps us to judge concrete actions. Distinguish that from just sort of our own uninformed desires or our passions or different emotions. How do we understand the relationship between conscience and the authority of the church? In the case of papal teaching, Newman makes that distinction between in the concrete acts, which the Pope doesn't declare in an infallible way, and more speculative general truths of faith and morals. One commentator said, for there to be a true collision between papal infallibility and my action in this moment, the Pope would have to make an infallible statement saying that I either should or shouldn't do this action in these exact circumstances. And that's just not what papal infallibility is. And finally, our duty to our conscience is absolute. The person is obliged to follow his or her conscience. And also we have that great responsibility, it is a responsibility, of forming the conscience. So that when we're following that inner voice of God, it truly is formed and shaped in accord with what is good. It does. So the difference between, say, a church teaching that you can point to more explicitly in the gospel, and right, but I don't think the church would make a distinction between their levels of infallibility. If it's considered infallible, then well, it takes us. I mean, in this context, Newman was certainly responding to challenges to papal infallibility, but it's part, I think, of the larger question of the church having the magisterial authority to say that this is true in an absolute way. So it comes back, I mean, to the great leap of faith that it takes to really believe that there's not a qualitative difference between church teaching, even if it's pronounced centuries later after Christ and Christ. And we really believe that this is the Church of Christ, guided by the Holy Spirit, and it has that authority to teach the truth. Okay? Just twice. Yeah, so Newman was talking about the conditions that would have that are necessary for us to be able to, in good conscience, oppose a papal teaching. And he was talking about when it's not an infallible teaching. So when it is, you say, well, we're mixing up our categories here. It's not our conscience that has as much to do with a papal teaching, because our conscience is that faculty that helps us to discern concrete actions in our life. So if the Pope were to make an infallible statement, one that's presented as infallible, and you don't believe it, or you have trouble with it, then, you know, as Catholics, we're asked to give assent to that, you know, religious assent, again, give them the benefit of the doubt. But it's a different operation from the conscience, is what Newman would say. Right. So, I don't know, how would we describe that if say there's a theological statement that's pronounced as infallible, the Immaculate Conception. And you might say, well, I have trouble believing that. So that's not the conscience so much. What is that? The faith? Or how would we describe that?
Doubt.
Doubt.
Doubt. Of course, believing is an act. It's just not a concrete action. Like, so to believe, an act is a process. So
no. It's only when he's speaking on faith and morals and intentionally as an infallible statement, where he wants to put the full weight of the Church's teaching authority behind it. So even when the Pope's speaking on faith and morals, which popes do every day, those are not infallible statements, because it's not ex cathedra. So that image of teaching from the chair of Peter, basically. And so it'd be very clear, and it is clear in the two cases where that's been done, like the language of the document says, you know, this is, we believe this to be revealed dogma. It is to be believed by all the faithful. Very rarely do you see that, you know, Pope Francis gives a homily. He doesn't say, like, this absolutely must be believed in order for you to be Catholic. Correct. Yeah, that's. Yeah. Yes, yeah, so it gets nuanced and confusing when you get into all these different levels of papal documents. And there's the ordinary magisterium, the extraordinary magisterium, all these ways in which the Church exercises its teaching office. Encyclical would be sort of the highest ordinary papal teaching, whereas encyclical is not an infallible statement. So documents from ecumenical councils and infallible statements of the Pope would be sort of those extraordinary, most power-packed magisterial teachings. But encyclical is higher than an apostolic exhortation, which is higher than a motu proprio.
We didn't really have an issue with
correct. Yeah, and Newman, he believed it. He thought it was problematic that the Church was defining it in that way at that time, because it took a lot of defense, a lot of explanations. Oh, what's the Church actually mean here? No, you're misunderstanding it. So trying to pull apart some of these threads to clarify the teaching was a challenge. But nothing that I read in him or commentary on him said that he had a personal problem with it in terms of his belief. And so he applied his experience and intellect to try to defend it and articulate it in a way that non-Catholics would understand and that Catholics would understand. It's not to be taken for granted. So, in the words of Jiminy Cricket, let your conscience be your guide, and have a good evening.